Good morning and welcome to this October 28th, 2015 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. I'm going to give you information on that later in the hour. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone. We are doing what we do every single Wednesday morning, which is talk with authors, not only about their books, but about writing process, creativity, craft, all the things that separate those of us who want to publish from those of us who actually do publish. It's my pleasure to welcome Lisa Gornick, and in the second half, I'm talking to Elizabeth Talent about her short story collection, Mendocino Fire, so stay with us for that. But first, Lisa. Lisa Gornick is the author of the novels A Private Sorcery, Tinderbox, and Louisa Meets Bear, which was out in June of this year. Her stories and essays have appeared widely, including in Agni, The Huffington Post, The New York Times, Prairie Schooner, Slate, and The Sun, and have been received many honors, including the Distinguished Story Award by Best American Short Stories. Lisa earned a doctorate in clinical psychology at Yale and is a graduate of the writing program at NYU and the psychoanalytic training program at Columbia, where she's on the faculty. For many years, she worked in clinics, hospitals, and private practice as a psychotherapist, a profession she has depicted in various essays as based on a sacred trust. At present, she lives in New York City with her husband and two sons. She's moving today, so an extra special thank you to Lisa for joining us on her moving day. I can't believe she's doing this. Thank you. Thank you. Louisa Meets Bear is the book we're talking about this morning. Thank you. Thank you so much, Lisa. Okay, so I have a really stupid first question that I'm kind of embarrassed to ask, but are these stories or is this a novel? Because as I was reading it, I kind of read it as both, and then as I was reading about it, I read it as both. So I want to give you a chance to introduce Louisa Meets Bear for those of us who haven't been lucky enough to read it yet, and sort of talk about it as stories or novel.
Well, that's a really good question, and I thought I'd written a collection of linked stories, and when the first reviews, the pre-pub reviews, came out in Publishers Weekly and Library Journal and some other places, it was described as a novel. And so I actually wrote a little essay for my publisher, Forrester and Drews, for their website literary magazine called Is My Book a Novel? In which I asked myself that question.
Oh, thank God. Okay. I was feeling kind of dumb. Good.
but I've decided that it falls in some kind of netherland in between the two, by which I mean there definitely is a through narrative, and I hope readers start at the beginning and read through to the end, and characters change over time, they develop, they're revisited, the themes amplify one another. So I guess in that sense, it is a novel, but it did begin as discrete stories, and each of the stories can be read independently, though I hope that they're enriched by one another.
Absolutely, they are. Did you publish them separately? Did they appear in journals separately?
8 of the 10 of them were published prior to Louisa Meets Bear separately, but they were so transformed when I put them back together. As you said, I'm moving today, so house and decorating and architectural themes are sort of on my mind, and I have been thinking about this in connection to the stories, in that my quite wonderful RISD painter said to me, it doesn't really matter exactly what sort of any one room if the color is painted. It has to do with the way things flow. It has to do with the way that one thing reverberates off of another thing.
Yeah.
And I think that's what happened with the stories. When I went back to put them together as a collection, I really had to radically change some of them, one, to just make the narrative flow, but also because the themes deepened between them, and I got to know all of my characters a great deal better.
Right, right. It's interesting because last week Anne Beatty was on the show with me, and we were talking about her latest collection is The State We're In. And some of those, there's a recurring character in 3 of those stories, but we were talking about linked collections, and her feeling was that it was dangerous to do it because a story If you force the stories to be connected, each one might lose something essential to what it needs to be in order to serve the collection. And I started thinking about that and wondering if I thought that was true or not. And I mean, I guess I can't decide. I thought that all of these worked so beautifully together, and getting a deeper sense of characters through one story. That's what I love about interconnected short stories, is that I get a deeper sense of character by looking at them from different points of view. So I think Anne's wrong.
Well, I don't know if she's wrong or not, but that was not the case for me in these stories. And I'll give you an example. One of the stories, Priest Pond, which is about a woman who's from rural Canada who comes to New York City, and she's in search of her son. They haven't really become estranged, but they've drifted apart, and she no longer really knows who he is or what his life is about. And when she comes to find him to inform him of his father's death, she learns a great deal about him. So that story was written independently of the title story, Louisa Meets Bear, which is really kind of a novella. Mm-hmm. And when I went to put them together, I had this thought of, what if this woman was Bear's sister?
Mm-hmm.
And it totally changed both of these stories. And suddenly I knew about her, which was not true in the original version of Priest Pond, that she had a younger brother who had gone to Princeton, become an investment banker, and lived a life that was radically different from hers. And that, in fact, she's going to come and stay with him. He's not in the story. He makes no appearance in the story, but we know that he's in the back of her mind. She's worrying, for instance, what will he think when she shows up at his apartment and she's driving a pickup truck?
Mm-hmm.
And then we also know later in the collection, when we revisit him in a story that's set in Rome, that he has this sister, and we see how radically different his life is from hers. So maybe in that sense, my collection, unlike Anne Baby's, really is a novel in that these things matter.
Yeah, they matter. Right, right. Now, I have read that you, as psychotherapist, like to do pretty extensive case studies on your characters, even, you know, and a lot of the case study probably doesn't even make it on the page. But in this case, it does seem like almost some of these short stories are case stories for other stories, you know, that you can do all of the work for these people and then watch how it all comes together. Because aren't we informed by, you know, history and generations ago and, you know, brothers we don't see very often, and they're all in our heads. They're all part of our DNA and you know, make up how we see the world and who we are. What a fun way to approach it.
Yeah. I certainly believe that. Someone once said to me that our personal histories start with the memories of our grandparents. Mm. And I thought that was kind of beautiful, because I can certainly remember my own grandparents telling me their stories, and their stories then became part of my inner life. And so I always feel with my characters, in novels and in short stories, that I really need to at least know who their grandparents were. So I can't imagine writing without that. And in a sense, that's how I ended up making the shift from short stories to novels. I was in the writing program, as you mentioned, at NYU, and E.L. Doctorow was one of my teachers. And after he'd read a number of my stories, he called me and he said, "This must be exhausting for you," meaning that you're inventing so many worlds every semester. And he said, "Why don't you try your hand at a novel?" And that certainly was a very appealing proposition for me. And I did go on and write a novel. But I do love the short story. I love it for its compression. I love the way that it can be structured around a single moment, and I love the attentiveness to language and the way it's closer to poetry, in a sense, than a novel is.
Yeah, And these stories are so incredibly poetic. You can tell that you spend a lot of time in the short story form. Probably spend a lot. I don't know if you spend a lot of time reading poetry, but it feels like that.
Well, I was just, you know, as I said, I'm moving today, and so I was literally unpacking my books like 13 minutes ago, and I thought, oh, gosh, I didn't realize I had so many volumes of poetry. And yes, I did start off writing poetry and reading poetry, and when I was at NYU, I spent a lot of time sort of studying poetry as well, but I consider myself very much an amateur as a poet.
Yeah, yeah. But you can tell the attention to language and detail and, you know, how the words rub up against each other and all of that in your writing is so pretty, so pretty. My guest this morning is Lisa Gornick. The book is Louisa Meets Bear. Without giving too much away of these stories, there are a lot of lost children. And I was wondering about writing into pain and writing into fear that a lot of writers talk about being so important to write about what scares us. And it was interesting, by the time I got to the story set in Venice, you had me so on edge about all of these children, lost children, that I was, you know, I was almost reading it with my hands over my eyes.
Oh, God.
And I was wondering if that was...
Venice, I guess, is that movie Don't Look Now.
That's what I thought. That's
about horrifying lost children in Venice, too.
That's exactly what I thought, yeah.
And, well, you know, I don't know that as a writer, I'm ever exactly aware that that's what I'm doing, is writing into pain. I mean, I think it's part of the nature of human life. I mean, loss and disappointment and death and even raising one's children, inherently, you have to let them go. Hopefully your parents die before you do, and so we experience that. I think it's just part of the nature of life, is being able to absorb loss.
Yeah. There were so many lovely, intimate moments in here. Your characters are so very, I don't know, intimate with each other. You know, they're like kind of shocking intimacy between mother and daughter and between lovers and between best friends, that they inhabit each other's sort of physical space in really neat ways, but really, but really intimate, almost hard to take ways for the reader. Really unusual. Really great.
Thank you. And one of the things that was striking for me when I went back to visit some of these stories I had written a long time ago was the extent to which I had been writing about things I had not yet experienced. For instance, writing about having children long before I'd had children, and being aware that there were things that I was chewing on and working out at almost a preconscious level about phases of life that would come later. And that was part of why I decided to put these together as a linked collection, that felt to me when I went back to look at them that there was a sort of development of a sensibility across the characters, starting in the first story, Instructions to Participant, with this young girl who's observing something her mother is going through and then watching her and her cousin develop through their teens and their early 20s until they enter into kind of deep middle age, is I guess what I would think about it as. Yeah. Not that I'm there myself.
Yeah, that is interesting, to be able to sort of anticipate what your own life is going to look like through writing. I wonder if that, you know, kind of calms you down or something.
I don't know. I mean, I just had a quite strange experience of this, of the new novel that I'm working on involves a hospice nurse. And when I began that novel, there was no thought in my mind that this is a person that I would get to know eventually in my real life. But sadly, as my parents aged, I did have to get to know very, very well a hospice nurse, and it occurred to me how strange that was, that I had begun writing years in advance of this actually happening. And coming back to the story Priest Pond, that I wrote that story long before I had a grown child, and although I'm lucky to not have that kind of estrangement, I certainly was already chewing on what does it feel like to lose touch with important aspects of your children's lives.
Right, right. Yeah, almost anticipating the grief that's to come and trying to work through it before it's there. Would you put it
right?
That way? Yeah, that's interesting. That's interesting.
Right.
Speaking of Priest Pond so many times, or speaking of Priest Pond today, there were a couple of different, there's a blind character in that story, and there were a couple of other blind characters very peripherally in the novel. And I thought blindness is such a great metaphor for characters. And I wonder if that comes about very organically in your writing, or if when you look back over things, you say, you know, that's a great symbol, or that's a great metaphor, or that's a, you know, that's a great image. But if they arise organically and it's something you look back on, or if these are very conscious in your mind saying, you know, blindness is a really wonderful metaphor for this story.
Oh, gee, now you're having me slightly
confused.
I can't even think of another blind character in this.
Well, they walked up, like she would walk up to a newsstand, and the guy she bought a newspaper from was blind.
Oh, you're right. Yes.
And I was like, interesting.
Bear buys from a blind, he goes to a coffee stand before he goes to work. Mm-hmm. Well, obviously not consciously planted, since I had even forgotten about that. The blindness is something I think that fascinates a lot of us in terms of, you know, what would it be like to not have sight, and what kind of extra sensitivities do people who manage without sight have? That's for sure. And in Priest Pond, that character goes from being sighted to non-sighted, so we see both sides of that there.
Yeah. Yeah. Were there characters in here who surprised you or gave you difficulty in particular in the collection?
Let me think for a moment. I certainly struggled a good deal with Andrew, who's the kind of bad boy that Louisa falls in love with and then becomes the husband of Marnie, who's a book illustrator. In the middle of the book, we discover that he's married a very different kind of woman, and he ends up telling her a story about his life and something that's happened in Guatemala. And I struggled with the story he tells, I think in the same way that his pregnant wife, Marnie, struggles with it, that was he culpable of having been an accomplice in what essentially was a murder? Mm-hmm. Or was it completely comprehensible that he was a young kid scared to death who kept his mouth shut at that moment? So Andrew, I was a character I definitely struggled with. Was he vulnerable or was he exploitative?
Yeah. Yeah, interesting. And how do you work through that? Did you write sort of case studies about Andrew that helped you understand him?
Well, I certainly, when you say case studies, I mean, I certainly knew a great deal about his parents, Hildy and George, and they enter into that story. We learn about the background. His mother, Hildy, is a professor at Berkeley, and she's kind of a political tour de force, and she lectures all over the country, and she's part of the debates in feminist theory in the 90s about what constitutes feminism. And so he has grown up in the shadow of her, and it was very important to me to understand sort of the impact that she'd had on him and the way that that had led him into leading a kind of secretive life.
Yeah.
Of sorts, starting when he was in his own adolescence. So is that a case history? I guess
yeah.
so. I felt
yeah.
like I really did understand his development from childhood forward.
Yeah. Yeah, I love this overlay of psychotherapy. There's such a great tradition of writers as psychotherapists. I know Amy Bloom and a couple of other really strong writers as psychotherapists. And all that brings to your understanding of human nature. And I always thought, you know, if I wasn't into writing, I would love to be a therapist, because you really get access to people's inner lives in a way that you just don't. Otherwise, people aren't going to confess these things.
Well, it's true, and that is why I became a psychotherapist. I was fascinated with storytelling. And so I had been a voracious reader as a child, and the very first experience I had with any kind of psychotherapy was I was a volunteer in a prison my first year of college, and there was a group therapy that was being led by an ex-con who now had gone on to get a degree in social work, and he ran group therapy sessions for the inmates. And when I began to hear their stories, it was just mesmerizing to me. And when I worked as a psychotherapist, which I don't any longer, I always felt like they came from exactly the same well, that what being a psychotherapist was about being able to hear people's stories and help them to make sense of their own narratives.
Yeah, right. And you find out how many things in human nature that you think are so weird and quirky about you are incredibly common, you know, and I guess that's why we come to literature, too, is to feel a little bit less alone and say, oh, you had that thought also, because I thought I was really weird to have that thought. But
absolutely. I think so. And I also think that the other thing that literature offers is an opportunity to feel compassion or to feel at least understanding for characters who are very different from ourselves. And that's, I think, one of the things why it's so important that young people read literature is I think it exercises our capacity for empathy and our capacity for understanding lives outside of our own.
Yeah, isn't that true?
Read Flannery O'Connor, you have to understand misfits and outsiders and religious fanatics in ways that you might not otherwise.
You know, bringing that point to another level, you wrote a great essay for, I think, for Real Simple magazine about a neighbor in your building who was an older alcoholic woman who smoked and ultimately ended up catching your apartment building on fire. And it was such a great essay. She's my dad, so I had a lot of sympathy for both sides of that story. And I was wondering if stories like that, you know, real life stories, sort of seep into your fiction. But does writing and psychotherapy give you? I mean, you seem to have such a great degree of empathy for her while you were angry with her. And I was wondering if all of the writing gives you empathy for real life people who are, you know, sometimes not so great.
Well, and it's interesting that you brought her up, because that's why I'm moving. I'm moving back into our building today,
wow.
By the way.
Gotcha.
And, I think that being a psychotherapist, and obviously when you're a therapist, you've been through a great deal of psychotherapy yourself, it pushed me to ask some questions of myself that were painful to ask, which was there anything that I or any of our neighbors could have done to prevent this? And that in that little essay, which listeners are interested, so it's on the newsstand now, it's the November Real Simple.
Oh, great.
In that little essay, I start off by telling this story that I thought proved how guiltless we were, our family, which is that I say that my older son had come home for that day, and he had said to me, "I smell smoke." And I said, "Oh, you can't possibly smell smoke. Miss P is in a nursing home. She can't be possibly smoking." And so I take that to mean that at first, the first time I tell that story, that how could we possibly be culpable for her setting her apartment on fire and ultimately herself, and it was a lethal fire for her. We didn't even know that she was living there. Mm. But by the end of the essay, I come around to ask myself, well, how did I not know that she'd moved back home?
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean, that I didn't even know she'd moved back home? And so it was a painful awareness for me to recognize that once I'd stopped being bothered by her smoke, I'd stop thinking about her.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So is that psychotherapy? Well, I've started the last few years to tell some of these some personal essays now that I'm not working as a psychotherapist, to tell some of these as personal essays, some of these stories, and is a genre now that I'm interested in. So I started with
poetry
and into short stories and novels, and now I've sort of added the personal essay to my repertoire here.
Well, I am going to follow those avidly because this essay was fantastic, and your insight into human nature and your own human nature, you know, your own sort of agency in her story, I thought was really fantastic, and all of that translates into fiction. You know, I think fiction is just as true as any short story. You know, the facts may be different, but the emotional truths are all exactly the same. And
I agree. And I'm very, very glad that I do have fiction because I do feel strongly about not writing about other people. I wrote about this in another essay for The Couch for the New York Times that I never wrote about, and I intend never in the future, any of my patients. I was very careful about that. And I feel the same way about my children and my students and people who over whom I've had some kind of authority or some sort of power, or what we would call in psychoanalysis, we evoke transference, where there's strong feelings that are directed towards us, that there's a sacred trust, and it's very important to not use other people's stories to promote
fodder.
Oneself in any way. So because I have fiction, I can take the essence, the kernel of what I know, and transform it into fiction and use that material in a completely fictive way that doesn't betray anybody's confidences. And that's, for that, I feel very lucky.
Yeah, right. My guest this morning is Lisa Gornick. The book is Louisa Meets Bear. We're running out of time, but you had a great quote about, I don't think I'll ever figure out what makes a novel work, in part because a novel, like a great city, keeps reinventing itself. And this novel is such a great example of that. If we're talking about it as a novel as opposed to linked short stories, that, you know, we always think that there's a particular structure to a novel, or that, you know, there are the eight themes that fiction covers. And this book, I think, in particular, is such a wonderful example of the novel, like you say, like great cities reinventing itself all the time, that it can take on a bunch of different forms. And the way that you deal with time and with character is so unique in this. And and what a great thing that the novel/short story collection has that flexibility and that sort of breadth.
Oh, well, and we're seeing this now between memoir and fiction, too. There's starting to be some blurred lines with writers like Elena Ferrante and Nausgaard, and the move towards, quote, autofiction. And so, yes, the novel does. It's a wonderful form.
Yeah, it is. What should we have talked about that we didn't? Do you have advice for writers that they can take away to their own work?
Well, this is, I don't know if I would call this advice, but it's something that I do that I find is very valuable, which is that I don't show my work until I feel like I've brought it as far as I can myself. And I know there are a lot of writers who work really differently. They're in writers' groups, and they'll show a chapter of a novel, and then they get feedback and so on. It's not that I don't think that may be helpful for some people, but the opposite approach also has some validity, which is to really allow your own vision to unfold and then put it down, reread, go back, and bring things to a place where what you're not seeing is not what's not developed, but your own blind spots. Mm-hmm. So after I've finished, say, a novel and I've gone through it three or four times, then I will give it to some trusted readers, and they will, if two or three people all say, you know, something isn't making sense or some character feels undeveloped in some way, then I absolutely will listen. So I guess that's my advice.
That is really good advice.
And don't submit your work too early. You know, let yourself finish your work, honor your own work.
Yeah, I love that. That is great advice. That is great advice. Lisa Gornick, this was a huge pleasure. Thank you so much. Good luck with your move.
Oh, thank you, Marie. This is really fun. I really enjoyed it.
Me too. That is Lisa Gornick. The book is Louisa Meets Bear. You can also read that great essay. It is out this month in Real Simple, and you can find out why Lisa is moving today. What a great pleasure that she took time out of her incredibly busy schedule for this. Stay tuned. Elizabeth Talent is going to be up next. You are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are on podcast. You can find us on iTunes under College Radio. You can always visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com. We are on Facebook. We are on Twitter. We are on Stitcher. There is no excuse not to be listening to us all the time. This interview will be up on the web shortly. I am your co-host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. Elizabeth Talent previously taught literature and creative writing right here at UCI, also at the Iowa Writers Workshop and at University of California, Davis. She is the author of the novel Museum Pieces and three collections of short stories, In Constant Flight, Time with Children, and Honey, and the study of John Updike's fiction, Married Men and Magic Tricks. Her work has appeared in The New Yorker, Esquire, Harper's, Grand Street, The Paris Review, in Best American Short Stories, and the O. Henry Award collections. Elizabeth's story, Tabris, received the 2008 Pushcart Prize Award. In 2007, she was awarded Stanford's Phi Beta Kappa Teaching Award. She's won a lot of awards in teaching, and hopefully we'll get to talk about some of her teaching today. Her short story, Never Come Back, appeared in the Penn O. Henry Prize Stories in 2011. Mendocino Fire is the latest collection. It is out this month. And her memoir, Perfectionism, will be out from Harper in 2016. My huge pleasure to welcome her on. Elizabeth, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming on. We've been waiting for this collection for a long time, for decades. I'm so glad it's here.
Yes.
I'm so glad it's here. So for people who haven't yet picked up Mendocino Fire, I'm just going to let you introduce it a little bit and talk about kind of the scope of the stories and kind of what was on your mind when you were putting the collection together.
Well, I think it's about people who are, in one way or another, in some kind of trouble that they're not really aware of. So I'm interested in this kind of dynamic of having a sense of something really going wrong. And then in the story, the character has to kind of figure out what it is exactly that's going on. So I guess they have a common plot, which is unearthing or kind of self-questioning, and sometimes it's questioning of things outside themselves as well, of our environmental plight.
Mm, right, right. There's a lot of near escapes, I noticed. A lot of the stories end on this note of people, you know, leaving, escaping,
quite. I like that feeling of threat, and then the sense that also, I suppose, I'm attracted to resilience and persistence in the face of threat. I think you're right about that. There's a kind of a note there that I probably strike at pretty often.
Yeah, yeah. You have a lot of wonderful father-son, tumultuous father-son relationships, and I was getting into that dynamic of you know, kind of the fault lines that happen between father and son, and I was wondering about accessing that voice. You've got some kind of salty some salty male characters in here that you get their voices so wonderfully right. Talk a little bit about your fascination with the father-son relationship and sort of getting into these men's heads.
I think that the father-son relationship is one of the most, it's sort of one of the most fascinating relationships within our culture, because male enculturation is so fraught with questions of how do you found an identity on maybe certain practices of aggression or self-assertion that
are no longer completely acceptable within the culture, and that the and the resistance to that, and the son trying to carve out a space that feels authentic to him. I just think when I watch that, when I see that in relationships, I find that really fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
In kind of the embattled quality of masculinity is attractive to me.
Yeah, yeah. And these stories are so informed by their setting. You know, the settings are often so rich. You've got sort of these abalone farmers who are kind of out on the water, feels very treacherous. There's another story that's kind of set in not a dump, but sort of a dump,
mm-hmm.
A disposal site. And the setting so informs who these people are and kind of, you know, what makes up their psychologies. Can you talk a little bit about setting and bringing place to life and kind of knowing these gritty areas well enough to map
them? Yeah, I'm really glad that you noticed that you see that in the stories, because it matters so much to me, that relationship with place. And I'm kind of seeing it as, in many ways, a harder relationship to be sure of, or even to trust that the place you live in will survive in some recognizable way into the future. So, again, it's a kind of, there's a vulnerability about place. And it happens that I live in a little town on the Mendocino coast where there's this tremendous sense of transition, because forestry has diminished and fishing was always a really dangerous way to make a living. But it's now hemmed in by all kinds of legislation, and all kinds of other issues are impinging on a way of life that probably existed from generation to generation. So, you know, there's just this profound sense of loss. And I think that short stories can really get into place in a way that's unique to the story form. And because you can write, the stories can have lots of different settings. And I've always wanted to write work that was very grounded in a particular place, and the way that people were trying to figure out how to love that place.
I like that. Do you start with place when you're at, kind of, how do these stories start? Do you start with an image? Do you start with a character? Do you start with the place?
You know, I always, this is like, there's so little that you know going in.
Yeah.
But I know where the story belongs. So that I feel good because I've got this one non-negotiable piece. Everything else is going to get erased and deleted and changed again and again. But where the story belongs is I feel like, I get that. I get that one piece to start with.
That's interesting. Where it belongs in setting, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah.
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 And I want to see it. I want to be able to. I'm very visual, so I want it. I need to be able to see it. And sometimes, you know, I want to find out more about it. So you get that wonderful thing of being able to research,
yeah.
and which feels like writing but isn't writing.
Right. It's a good excuse for writing.
Because you're learning more about the place.
Yeah, yeah. My guest this morning is Elizabeth Talent. The book is Mendocino Fire. So many of these stories have a great... beyond the setting, they have some great touchstone of an object. Like I was mentioning, you have abalone, or in one story, you have this really wonderfully rich, well-described oriental rug. And I was wondering about the role of objects for you, and choosing the right objects, and kind of what objects mean to you in relation to the characters in the stories.
But again, I mean, I think that's something that comes from my background was in archaeology, which is really about trying to imagine a way of life because of an object. sometimes it's something you can hold in your hand, like a fragment of an ancient pot or a projectile point that was chipped out in 1100 A.D. So you've got an object, and from there you are conjecturing about the person who made it. So, I have never really lost my sense that we have this relationship with the things we've made or the things we encounter, that it's more charged. I have a feeling that it's a little bit under-recognized emotionally in our culture, although we're highly materialistic, but that the actual evocativeness or the emotional valence of objects gets a little bit downplayed. So you're right to notice that. I'm happy, again, that you've seen that in the work.
So great. So there are a couple of, I don't want to call them devices, but there are a couple of things that you do in here that I think are I haven't seen before and I think are really interesting. One of those is that you put in one of these stories, I'm going to remember which one, I think it's in Tabrets, you put in the children's mouths dialogue that reflects the emotional difficulties between their parents. And I haven't seen that done before, and I think it's a very interesting way to up dialogue, because I think dialogue is difficult for writers to mm-hmm. write, and B, to bring a different emotional resonance and a different psychological understanding to your characters, that you can give dialogue to children in their play that will reflect what's going on in the parents' marriage. I don't even know what my question is, except that that's brilliant. Good job.
It's one reason children are great presences in fiction, is because they have these intense perceptions, and they're often incredibly accurate emotional readings of what's going on around them. But their language is going to be very indirect and coded, or they are engaged with each other, so that the manifestation of what they actually know is going to be oblique. And that just gives you another angle introduced into the story. And then you've got the child's psyche working on whatever is going on emotionally in the story. So even well before I had my own child, I really loved having children in the stories, because they handle sort of reality and information in a quite different way. But they're often very honest. It's like before the deformation of the psyche, before all the concepts of politeness and acceptability. It's before that, so you get these great observers, and it's just good luck if they can play a part in a story.
And it's very difficult to manage all of those advantages of working with children and then actually writing them authentically and making them, you know, children are difficult to write. So hats off to you for making these characters in-depth and interesting and reverberating off of what's happening with the adults. That's not easy to do.
Thank you. Now that my son is 28 years old, I was just like, you know, I have some notebooks that I wish I'd written down every single thing he ever said. Now it's like, there was just such great language and such great inventiveness.
Yes. Yeah, because children don't know cliches and idioms, they come up with incredibly inventive ways to look at the world. And I agree. You know, it was such a shame when I realized my daughter was starting to learn all of the idioms, because it took away all of those really colorful ways that she was using to describe the world. And you're right.
You're right. There is a kind of parental mourning when you get to that moment. You're like, okay, now the culture has taken over and colonized this incredible imagination. So you see it. So once I said to my son, hey, okay, hold on, you just hold your horses. And he got really quiet, and then he said, Mom, where are my horses?
Right, right. I know you don't want to strip them of the, you know, how do you put them in a bubble? But yeah, it's it's a shame we can't. The one of the other things that I wanted to point out that you do so well, and I mean, I really have to sit down and study these stories for how you do it. But your management of time, I think, is really very interesting. You, time and time again, will have a dense paragraph where within the paragraph or within just one sentence, characters will move locations and we will find ourselves someplace completely different that makes perfect emotional sense. But the play with time, I think, is really interesting that, you know, normally we would see a paragraph break or we would see a, you know, a piece of white space. So we know that we've moved, but you don't do that. And I think it creates a really interesting tension with the reader kind of doesn't know where we are, but it makes perfect emotional sense. And I was wondering if you could talk about that.
Yeah. Well, thank you for saying that. I think I get in a lot of trouble with time because I kind of don't believe in time. I have trouble with it in real life, and I think so some of that is just helplessly imprinted in the stories that the movement would just be emotional. And for when I would get in trouble sometimes with editors or copy editors who would be wanting the paragraphs to change with the shift in time, and I would have to argue, no, and this is all of a piece emotionally. So it was a little bit like I wanted the paragraph to be an emotional unit, and I was really relatively unaware of and indifferent to the idea of this kind of chronological indexing. It just wasn't something that feels real to me, so it might be a case of that kind of unawareness on my part finally translating into something on the page.
It's brilliant. I never read stories with a highlighter, and I forced myself to get up out of my chair begrudgingly because standing up is no fun, and go get a highlighter and start marking so many lines. Now the book is just all yellow. But so many amazing shifts. I mean, you really are a writer's writer because I think, you know, these stories are really meant to more to be studied than to be. I mean, they're certainly to be enjoyed, but they're really to be studied for your mastery of craft. And I'll just have to spend more time reading them over and over again. Go ahead. Go ahead.
I like short stories because I think they want that from a reader. They really saying, look, this is going to be a small piece of your time as a reader. So let's make it really as serious as we can. Let's ask as much of you, the reader. Let's ask as much as we possibly can. Because I like that when I'm reading. I like to feel like a story is asking for consummate intelligence from me and a kind of as much energy as I can bring to the page as a reader. So I like that. I like that on both sides. I like to try that as a writer and to make it be a really kind of intricate experience.
I like the way you say that because that was my experience of reading it, that if you took your attention away from the page for even a sentence, you can't do that in your work. I mean, you really need to be present and engaged and thinking every single word of the way, or A, you're going to get lost, and B, you're going to miss something so important that it felt like even though these were short stories, they were, you know, kind of entire novels contained in each one of these stories, that each word, you always hear that about short stories, that each word has to do a lot of work because they're short. This is an example where it was really true. I mean, every sentence really did do its job, and the tightness and I don't know, constraint that you had was really just remarkable. Can we talk a little bit about titling stories? Because these have wonderful titles. I'm not even sure that I understand Talbrandt's, but I love the title of it. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think kind of titles are the writer's one chance to kind of talk over the head of the story right to the reader and say something like, this is what I'm thinking about this. And so there's a kind of a directness of communion with the title itself that is not true of the rest of the text necessarily. So I just think of them as little signals, but also sometimes I'm just attracted to something that's maybe a little bit odd in the word itself. And with even the title Mendocino Fire, I liked the tension between Mendocino, which I think of as really a lush, just green and soft and rainy sort of place, and then fire being the opposite of that. So for me, I'm not sure it would seem that way to anyone else ever. And in fact, it was kind of a problem about the website for the book because, of course, our local fire company is MendocinoFire.com. So there was a little problem with that. I guess I'm looking for something that's a signal but also has a little bit of that estranging effect.
Yes, right. The book was originally going to be called Mendocino. It started with a V. What was it? Mendocino. Not Phil. I mean, I had read an article from years ago before the collection came out, and it had a different title, I thought. Can't remember.
That's probably true. Since I've lived with it for a long time, it's gone through a couple of different titles. And I think a working title shouldn't be the title you end up with, that the working title means this is in process. So I often have a different working title.
Yeah, right. Which actually is a good idea because it sort of means the book has now been born, you know, something about changing the title after you look over the course of the 10 stories and how they gel together and make sense. That's what I say about titles. It's so hard for short story writers because, you know, they have to do the work of a novelist title something once and short story has to do it, you know, 10 or 11 times. It's hardly seems fair. Sadly,
titles that kind of do like them. I like making a list and looking at it, and yeah, I mean, there's also something pleasurable about the process.
Yeah, I mean, they're little puzzles, right? As you say, they allow you to sort of step out of the piece and I don't know, look at it from a different angle, maybe, or you know, kind of get a different prism on the story.
That's true, and also because while you're working on it, you are thinking about different angles, so sometimes the title you've got at the moment is about that angle.
Yeah, right.
And you're really going to end up somewhere else.
Right. Last-minute words of writing, wisdom, advice, what you tell your students. I know you've gotten so many awards for your wonderful teaching all over the place, including here at UCI and up at Stanford. What writing advice do you
have? One of the most phenomenal writing programs right there, and it's just got incredible teachers and writers who are working there. So I really always loved the program there at UCI.
Yeah,
it is. Michelle Latulay is a phenomenal presence as far as the work she's done with all the writers she's worked with.
Isn't
all
it great?
The young writers coming out of your program.
Yeah, and Ron Carlson is great. No, it's a wonderful program. If you can get into it, it's a wonderful program.
It is difficult getting in at all. That's true of all the top programs.
Yeah, right. Any last words of writing? What do you tell your students?
I probably say the thing that a lot of writers say, which is just read. Just read everything that interests you. You should read very seriously. And I say if you find one or two writers that you really love, read every single thing you can find by that writer so you know that writer's entire body of work, because that exposure to a writer's life, to a writer's work from beginning to end, is going to teach you something about what it is to have a life in writing that you can't get any other way.
Yeah, exactly right. Wonderful advice. Elizabeth, thank you so much for taking the time this morning. This was wonderful. What a treat.
My pleasure.
Thank you. That was Elizabeth Talent. The book is Mendocino Fire. It is a long-awaited collection. It had been decades since her last collection. Every word of this is worth your time and attention. I really highly recommend it. You can find more about Elizabeth online. That's all the time we have for today. We'll be right back here with you next Wednesday morning, as we always do. Thanks so much for joining me. Stay tuned for Sister Rue coming up with some reggae and taking you through your Wednesday morning. Thanks for joining me. Have a great day.